Welcome to another program of Once Upon an Island, Tales from Lopez. I'm Ali Smulders. With me is
Laurie Harrison. And we're bringing you our traditional December version of Once Upon an Island. And in December, Ali and I sit in front of the fire and enjoy sharing our favorite traditional Christmas stories with you, both from other authors and from our own childhood. Today also, we're going to be sharing with you some of our favorite memories of traditional Christmases and Christmas activities here on Lopez Island.
Well, we are well into the month of December, the last month of the year. That month that has so many holidays, both religious and secular. We all have our own ways of observing those holidays, our own special foods, cookies, goodies that we maybe grew up with, or that came from grandma's house, or even further back to the countries where our families originally came from. There are so many different traditions, but one thing we all have in common, we all miss those family members and those friends who used to be here for Christmas with us and who are no longer alive, who have gone before us. And this makes our holidays, actually, our festivities, bittersweet. There is a Russian tradition where the food is a porridge that they eat, a very thick porridge of either rice or wheat, and it has all kinds of good stuff in it, like honey and poppy seeds and raisins and nuts. And when the family sits down to eat that very special porridge, they have an extra bowl set aside for those who are no longer with us. And everyone says, "We remember." The year of 2009 has been an especially hard one and continues to be hard for Lopez Island. Our community lost an unusually large number of Lopezians. And we tend to be more accepting when people die after they've lived a good, long life. But when people die like many of them did, when they were still in their prime, we find that very hard to accept. And we find it difficult to have our holidays without them. But like the Russian family, we as a community stop for a moment as we say, "We remember."
Thank you, Ali. The next two stories that we are going to offer to you both deal with the true meaning of Christmas. The first story I'll be reading to you from author Farrell Sams. The name of the book is Christmas Gift. Farrell Sams is a physician in Fayetteville, Georgia. He published this book in the late 1980s. And I'm going to read to you the beginning few chapters. This was the best Christmas we ever had. It had to be, because it always is. I heard my mother say so every year. It was she who protested that she didn't want a present. She just wanted us all to be together, to love one another. It was she who feared that seasonal frenzy would overshadow the eternal verities. She was apprehensive that we might get so caught up in the excitement of giving, and regardless of what anyone tried to teach us, of getting, that we would ignore the true meaning of Christmas. She would have loved this one. Last year, the family was broke, and we said, let's don't give any presents. Then we dipped into reserves and gave them anyway. This year, even the reserves were gone. There was still, however, the thrill in the heart, the building excitement, the rush of preparation. There was still the awareness of hope, the weary world rejoicing. I felt it. I watched it. I pondered. Many people nowadays say that Christmas is for children, thus appearing a little world-weary, skeptical of the new and glorious morn, forgetful that joy itself is primitive. Perhaps they've misplaced their sense of wonder and can no longer experience awe. But they are right. Christmas is for children. This was the Christmas that I set aside grief. I could not have done it without children. I did not forget my parents, my grandparents, my aunts and uncles, all of whom who have died, but I gave up mourning for them. I still have more on this side of the Jordan than the other, because friends and family keep multiplying. They are a great blessing. I am now a patriarch. My memories cover 6 decades. And at Christmas, I am a child again. And it is my grandchildren who have given this to me. This was the year that I bribed 5-year-old Sarah Kate to say hee-haw in the Christmas pageant. I offered her $5, but she held out for 7. Her mother wanted her to be an angel, primarily because that costume is easier to make. But Sarah Kate willfully insisted on being a donkey, and her mother indulged her. She very nearly indulged me when that hee-haw broke loose in the whole church. And this was the year that little Helen, shyly approaching her teens, put her arms around my neck spontaneously and said, Sambi, I love you. It was the year that Miss Margaret, a pragmatist at age 5, listened in Sunday school to a local version of The Travail of Christmas. No room in the inn, the birth in the stable, cradling in an animal trough. And being able to endure it no longer, she comforted her classmates by saying, it's all right, he's going to die anyhow. This was the year that brothers Beau and Barclay did not fight a single time for a whole day. William Joseph, our blessed Downs child, age 6, proudly and accurately delivered presents at Aunt Sarah's Christmas tree. And this was the year that Jimbo and Fletch went to the cemetery with me. These are all my grandchildren, and they made Christmas. Now I would like to make one for all of them. I can remember their parents as children, their great aunts when they were children, their great grandparents and their great great grandparents. I have 66 years of Christmas past within me, and I give it to them. Our family is lucky. People speak and write these days about having a sense of place, but ours is visible. It is still tangible. It is the house, and our house still stands. In 150 years, it has survived the Civil War and carpetbaggers and boll weevils and even the Great Depression. Miss Sis and Mr. Jim were my grandparents. We called them Mammy and Pa. We lived with them in the house, my parents, my 3 sisters, my aunt and her husband, and me. Mammy's father had built the house, and until she died, it was hers. At Christmas, Mammy and Pa's other children all came. 2 of them lived way off in Atlanta and Jackson, and on Christmas Eve they had to spend the night, making 8 more people who slept there. The pallets the grown-ups made of quilts and put on the floor for us children weren't too bad. We were so excited we hardly slept anyways. We kept waking up, wondering if Santa Claus had come. I always slept with my older cousin, Pete Giles, and that was not a bad arrangement. Pete and I were going to fight wherever we were anyhow, awake or asleep, and the pallets were as good a place as any. Quit kicking!
I'm not kicking. I'm just turning over.
You are too kicking.
No, I'm not.
Yes, you are. Here, I'll show you some real kicking.
As Fayette County, Georgia, was tilting ever so gradually further and further away from the sun, our days shortened and our pace on the farm quickened. We had less time to do everything. First light from milking the cows came later each morning, and before the cows' bags had time to fill up, it was time to be done all over again in the crisp, fast-falling dusk of afternoon. There was no farmyard dawdling in December. The temperature dropped quickly in those bobtail days, and we kept up with it. Stove wood was carried in from the woodlot to the big box behind the kitchen stove. The handful of daylight that we had was packed full, killing hogs, feeding the mules, hilling the sweet potatoes, taking coal to the fireplaces, carrying Mammy's potted plants to the flower pit. Make haste before the dark catches you, son. We did. We made haste about everything. The hours themselves grew faster as the time between summer and winter came closer and closer. And then the ladies of the family and the community crammed into their schedules the added excitement of cooking and baking and preparing all the Christmas delicacies. They obviously enjoyed it. Are you about ready for Christmas? Lawsy mercy, no. Only two cakes done, and not enough daylight to turn around in.
I brought a book called This Way to Christmas by Ruth Sawyer. Ruth Sawyer died in 1970 at the age of 90. She was especially in the East, in New York and Boston, and she was a famous storyteller, a writer of children's books, and also somebody very knowledgeable of folklore. And this book, This Way to Christmas, was published in 1916, a long time ago. It was republished several times all the way into the 50s. And I'm very happy to tell you the library still has a copy of it. This Way to Christmas is really a very special book because it has so many Christmas stories in it. But the story that I will tell you is the story around the stories, how it all came about. And I want you to imagine a young family who live in New York. The father is a scientist, and they have an 8-year-old boy, David. But David is 8, going on 9. He is very much aware of that. The father is a scientist, and David doesn't quite know what that means, except he is very knowledgeable, and he has little time for boys. And mother has to always watch out for him, because he forgets to put on, rubbers when it rains, or he forgets to put on a coat when it's cold. So one day when father comes home, and I want you to remember, this is during the First World War. And father comes home and says, I have to go to the Eastern Front, which means where Germany is fighting Russia. This is in the beginning of the First World War which was from 1914 to 1918, and the United States got involved in 1917, but all this happened long before that. And Father says that he is needed as a scientist to check out some illness that is going on there on the Eastern Front. And Mother says, I will have to go with you, because you can barely take care of yourself in a civilized country, let alone in a war zone. And David tries to be very brave, but he doesn't like the idea that his parents will go across the Atlantic, across Europe, all the way to the war, and leaving him where? Well, with Johanna. Johanna was his nursemaid, and she lived with them when David was a tiny baby. And after that, when he grew up to be 8 going on 9, mm-hmm. I mean, she was long gone, and she had married Barney. Well, Johanna is Irish, and so is Barney. And they live in the hill country, where they take care of a summer hotel that closes for the summer. And they live in the lodge. And that's where David is going to go. Well, they have told him that there will be untold fun things to do, like toboggan sliding. There will be, he will learn to ski. He will be skating on the beaver pond. They tell him all these beautiful things. But in the back of his mind, he thinks, but I had to say goodbye to the boys on the block. And my parents who go all the way far, far away from me. And what about, it's already fall, what about Christmas? He doesn't quite want to go there. And Johanna, who notices that this is not an easy time for him, says, have you been thinking of the fairy stories that I've told you? And David has to admit that in the city, you don't really think about fairies very much anymore. Ha, but now you're going to the country, says Johanna. And have you thought of the locked-out fairy possibilities? And David says, what was it again about the locked-out fairy? And Johanna explains to him that for the fairies in Ireland, the summer lasts from the 1st of May, or actually the night before, to the end of October. And then the summer comes to an end and they have to go in. They have to go to where they live between the roots of trees in their rath, R-A-T-H. Don't ask me what that really means, but it is the dwelling of the Irish fairies. And they close it up on October 31st. And then there is always some fairy coming too late and seeing the little wooden window, tiny window, go open and being told, sorry about that. You will have to come back 1st of May. But fortunately, there is a little out, because that's what Johanna tells David. Every year when it is a snowy year, there will be a tiny opportunity on Christmas Eve. And David has been thinking about these stories as he is sitting in the window nook waiting for Johanna to fix supper. And he looks at the hill, the mountain really, where he can see 4 lights slowly being lit. And he thinks about the people who live there. But Johanna tells him they're all heathens. Well, David is not quite sure what all that means. But he is thinking about the locked out fairy and wondering how would the locked out fairy come to the United States? Oh, easy, says Johanna. Because so many of the Irish come to the United States, it just comes along. Oh, sure enough. But how would it stay warm? Because wouldn't it be cold for a fairy in summer clothing? And then he looks out the window, and what does he see? It looks like a squirrel, but he sees a little blonde lock of hair underneath the squirrel coat, underneath the little head that is over a fairy's head. And he opens the window quickly, and in comes the locked-out fairy. And the locked-out fairy looks really like a squirrel if you don't look too closely. And so this locked-out fairy says to David, "You think so? You think I look well? Ha! You should listen to the squirrels. They think nothing. I am not doing too well." "Well," says David, "I didn't see you." "I noticed. I have been trying to make you see me every single day. What's the matter with your eyes?" And David is so happy to see him, and he talks about the fact that, "Oh, I'm so glad to see you. And it's almost Christmas, and we won't have any Christmas." "No Christmas? What's that about?" And David says, "Well, there are no toy stores, and there are no places where you can buy Christmas fixings and all the good things that make for surprises. None of that is here." And the fairy interrupts him and says, "Christmas is in the hearts and memories of good people everywhere." And David says, "But are there any good people?" And the fairy says, "What do you think those lights are? Just as good as here." "Oh, no," says David. "Johanna says they're the heathens. Don't you say those words. When you want to find Christmas, you better only say good things about people. And I'll make a bargain with you. If you will just think good things about people, I tell you that Christmas is in the memories and the hearts of good people everywhere, and I'll lead you to it. Not tonight, it's too snowy, but I will come tomorrow morning, and you will go and find out about those lights and the good people who live there." And the fairy says goodbye and goes out the window. Not until David had given him a few nuts that he had in his pocket. And the fairy puts those in a little pocket of his own fairy suit and then waves goodbye to David. And just at that moment, Barney comes and says, "Are you asleep?" "Asleep," says Barney, says David, and he is about to tell what had just happened, but he decides not to. And Barney says, "Oh, were you dreaming about the locked-out fairy?" David doesn't answer that, and they go back to the kitchen, where Johanna has made a delicious meal with Irish bread cooked on the griddle and chicken broth with dumplings. What else could a boy want on a winter evening? Well, the next morning, early, as soon as it is the right time after breakfast, David goes outside and the fairy is waiting for him. And he follows the little squirrel prince everywhere. And where does he go? He goes to the first light, the lowest light, which is the flagman, who takes care of the flags of the train when necessary. The flagman is German, and you can just imagine what Johanna had to say about him. But as soon as David meets the flagman, he feels good about it. Fritz Grossmann tells a Christmas story to David and is just delighted to have a child visit him. And that evening, David tells the same story again to Barney and Johanna, who is really surprised to have such a beautiful story coming from the flagman. Well, the next day it has really snowed. It is like a snowstorm. But both Barney and Johanna say, "It's not bad enough for you to stay home. You can go, but dress warmly." And so he goes, and where does he go? He goes to the lumber camp. The lumber camp is deserted because the company figured they would not cut any lumber for a few years, but they had to find somebody to stay and take care of things and make sure that the camp was safe. And they gave that job to Uncle Job, who was the cook at the camp. And I must admit that David was a little bit scared when he looked in the window and saw this very black man, very black man looking at him. Or in those days, of course, they said this black Negro, because that was still the word that was used everywhere. And he invites David in, and they have the best of time. And Uncle Job tells him a Christmas story of his own, a Christmas story of old Virginia, where he came from. And then the following day, there is more snow, but it is pretty safe, and so David is allowed to go out again. And the fairy is there. The squirrel prints are there for him to follow. And this time, they go to the cottage where the lunger lives, as Johanna has told him. Well, it turns out it is a mother from South America with her son. The son had come to the United States to go to the university, and he got, as he calls it, the cough, tuberculosis. And the doctor suggested that he not go back to his own country, way too hot and not good for him with his illness, but that they should stay here in the hill country, where he could be outside and rest and definitely would get well again. And it didn't matter that it was going to be winter again, because that was okay too. He could be outside on a outside porch with a big fire going. He would be fine. Well, this is what David hears when he gets there. But the mother is so thrilled and surprised to find a Chico, as she calls him, to come and visit with them. And David, who has learned a lot in the time that he has been with Johanna and Barney, makes new fires for them, because they have no knowledge of how to make a wood fire. They use coal in South America, and the mother was used to a servant, and there is no servant there anymore. So David just does make them very happy, because they get warm and they get very pleased with the boy who comes and says, "I have been going to," and he tells the stories that went before of the flagman and of Uncle Job. And the boy says, the sick boy says, "Mother, don't we have a story?" And so Mother tells a story of her native Spain. And David brings that story again to Barney and Johanna that evening. And then finally, the fourth light that he still has to visit turns out to be the trap man, the man who sets traps to catch the animals that live in the hill country. Because he came from a country in the Middle East that is no longer there, and he can never go home again, and he has to make a living somehow. So the trap man explains, the trapper explains all that to David. And then he tells a story from the country where he came from the gypsies who lived there. Well, David comes home that night. Actually, he's being brought home by the trapper because the wind has come up, and this is a high mountain that David had to climb. So he says, I'll bring you home. And both Johanna and Barney were already looking for him. And Barney had checked different places to see, where did that little boy go? Well, he's safely home again. And he tells the trapper story to Johanna and Barney. And then, just a few days before Christmas, somebody knocks at the door. And who's that but Mr. Peter? And David had already heard about Mr. Peter, who was a guest in the summer, and who said he would come back because he is a painter and he likes to paint the snow scenes. Well, Mr. Peter had another reason. He doesn't believe in Christmas. So how about that? Can I escape it here? And then he notices David and says, oh my goodness, a boy. One can never escape Christmas when there are boys around. So Mr. Peter, Barney and David get together and plan. And they plan to have signs put up near the homes, the little huts and cabins and the cottage of all the people on the hill, and invite them to Christmas Eve dinner. And Barney talks with Johanna, who is most happy to start cooking. And she does. She starts cooking. You know how that is. Days. So there are only a few days left. So she is in the kitchen most of the time, while the men place the big signs that has beautiful decorations on it that Mr. Peter took care of. And Mr. Peter also promises David that he will make sure that a South American lady and her son can come, because they cannot walk in the snow. But he says, I will make sure that they have a sled to bring them here. And you can imagine what that Christmas meal on Christmas Eve was like. Chicken and ham, and the smells were so good, and the decorations were fantastic, and the candles were all burning. And Uncle Job insists on serving, and he says, I haven't smelled chicken as good as this since I left Old Virginia. Well, the meal is wonderful, and David is especially happy because that day a letter had come from his father promising that there will be a very special gift for him that will arrive on Christmas Day. It's hard for him to imagine what that is. And Johanna says, maybe it's an elephant. And David says, there are no elephants in Eastern Germany. But he doesn't know what it will be. He does know that his father, whenever he comes up with a gift, gives something that he himself really likes. So therefore, David is hoping for the best. Well, I must tell you that on Christmas Eve, the festivities went on till past midnight, because Johanna had to tell a Christmas story too, and she did. An Irish one. But when everybody has left, David has to be helped to bed. He is so tired that his eyes won't stay open anymore. So they sleep in the next morning, and they have a late breakfast. And during breakfast, somebody is knocking at the door. And Barney goes to answer it, and it's the trapper, but he doesn't want to come in. He wants to talk to David. And David goes, and the trapper says to him, look what I have for you. And it is the squirrel skin of the locked out fairy. And the trapper says, "This was taken from my barn. And I had several people that I thought had taken it, but it turns out it was your locked-out fairy who was using it all fall and then brought it back. And I thought you should have it so that you can really enjoy the memory and have something tangible to hold." And with that, the trapper set off again. And David was just glowing with pleasure because he knew this meant that the fairy had gone back to Ireland. And no doubt, since it had been a snowy year, it would get back in the rath and would be safe for the rest of the winter. Ah, such joy. Well, they finished breakfast, and then the phone rang, and Barney answered it and was just all aglow. He said, "Ah, but I can't tell you. I can't tell you, but your present is on its way. It's coming by coach." "By coach? Is it that big?" David can't imagine. And Johanna talks again about big animals, because she is very certain that it will be a most unusual thing. Well, the bells they hear of the coach coming closer, and they all go to the front door, and everybody is just looking and looking. And then Barney says, "There's somebody beside the driver." And David sees that too. And everybody is calling out Merry Christmas, but David cannot say anything. He can only whisper, "It's Mother. It's Mother."
Thank you, Allie. A beautiful story about the locked out fairy and the true meaning of Christmas. Well, over the last few weeks, when Allie and I were preparing to do this show for Christmas, we spent a lot of time thinking about our own memories and what was most meaningful to us in our childhoods. Was it the presents that we gave? Was it the presents we received? Was it Santa? Was it listening for the reindeer? Was it the meal or the family times? For myself, I was so surprised to realize, Allie, that I couldn't remember back. Remembering back, I couldn't remember many of the presents that I'd received. And that surprised me. You know, thinking about all the efforts as a parent that I put into preparing gifts for my children. And I know my parents put in so much time and effort for the gifts they gave me. I'm a little confounded by it and a little surprised that I just can't remember many of the gifts that I was given throughout all the years. And I'm kind of interested to wonder if the people that are listening, too, if they gave some time to that question, you know, what would come up for them about what was the most meaningful for them looking back on their Christmas holidays or their winter holidays. So I was surprised that it wasn't gifts, Allie, and what it came down to for me was much more about experience. And so I spent a little time the other day writing a very short piece about two of those experiences, which held a lot of meaning for me when I was growing up as a little girl in Seattle. And I'd like to read that to you now.
Great.
The wind on Lopez is howling tonight, bashing the windows with heavy blows, making the walls of my cottage shake. Snow may be on the way. It's cold enough, that's for certain. Well, maybe it's the weather or that we're in December now, but I'm dreaming about sledding as a kid in the old Seattle neighborhood. It only happened this way once. One magical night when the parents and the kids poured out of the houses on our little street. We were all bundled up in our mittens and hats, our jackets, our rubber boots, and snow pants. Our family brought kitchen things for sledding, pie plates and cookie sheets. Perhaps one of my brothers had a real plastic snow saucer, but mainly we improvised. I remember the deep quiet. Sure, the kids and grown-ups were laughing and calling back and forth, but in the spaces between was the deep magic that accompanies a snowfall. And that's what I most remember. I have this image in my mind's eye of the snow drifting down in the light of our one street lamp, silent as bird feathers. There may have been a dozen of us out on that cold night, kids and parents. We headed for Baumgartner's Hill, where it was steep enough to get a real ride. The snow clumped on my mittens, and I bit the chunks off. My fingers were cold, and my toes in my red rain boots were already feeling frozen. I'd prepared well enough, pulling on three pairs of cotton socks, but the snow was slipping down into those boots and puddling and making my cramped little toes into icicles. But nothing was going to send me back indoors that night. The black night air full of quiet snow, the smiling faces of all the grown-ups, us kids jockeying for position, getting ready, and then the feeling of my dad's big hands on my back. Whoosh! Down the hill I went.
Lovely.
Here's one other little memory that is very clear to me, and I'm imagining that this happened, that my first memory of this was probably, golly, when I was 6 years old or 7 years old. Once a year I had the treat of getting to go to sleep in my parents' bed. It wasn't on Christmas Eve, but it was always during the season. I know that for certain because of the Christmas lights outside their window. They hung like a necklace of blue, green, red, and white pearls, casting a glow into the room. It mesmerized me. I lay on my back in their big bed, the woolen blanket pulled up to my chest, with the cool cotton sheet folded over, my hands on the outside clasped together. The glow of those Christmas lights was sheer magic for that little girl. Laying there quiet as kitten, I tried so hard to keep my eyes open. Even now, 50-some years later, I leave the Christmas lights outside my bedroom window on one night each year, always hoping to find that same dreamy land that I knew as a child.
Beautiful.
And Allie, you've got some memories that you want to share, probably about a time in Friesland.
Right. I think I will start with a visit to my grandmother. And this was more a winter memory, not so much a Christmas one, although it may very well have been between Christmas and New Year's. My mother and I would go together by steam tram, and then we would get off the tram at a tavern in a village, and we had to walk another half hour alongside a canal, and it was not just a canal, but there were also side smaller canals, and there were little bridges over these, and you had to hold on to one railing. I mean, it was quite a ways, and if I went alone, which happened by the time I was about 9 years old, my mother would put me in the care of the conductor, and I would just go by myself. Then my aunt would come and meet me at a tavern, and we would walk together. They would not let me walk the half hour all by myself. But with my mother, we were, of course, talking, and Sometimes somebody would stop us and they would say to us, "Are you going to talk for a day?" I mean, that's a very strange thing to say, but geen jimme en die te praten in Frisian. And that was their way of putting it, because they knew that we came from the outside world and that this village was so, you know, alone and deserted, and so few people came and passed the time of day, that when you came from the outside world, you really came to talk, to bring news from what was happening in the places that were, you know, more accessible. Even the doctor had to walk there. He could not come on a horse or any old way. You know, he would put his little, whatever he was driving, a little car probably. The doctors had cars. Nobody else did. But he would have to walk and come with his bag, walking to the houses where people were sick. But on this day, we would come, and then my grandmother would be sure to have two foot warmers ready for us. A foot warmer was a kind of like a wooden box with holes in the top, and in the wooden box that was open on one side, they would put a ceramic kind of a small bowl that held hot coals, and the coals were coals of peat, turf, whatever you want to call it. In Ireland and Scotland they say turf, and in Dutch we say turf, and in Frisian we do so, but it is peat, because this is an old peat colony, and that's why you have these big canals. But this, in most places, these peat colonies had totally changed and roads had been built, not here. Where my father grew up, where my grandmother still lived, it was a very old-fashioned place. And we would be greeted with these foot warmers, where the hot air would come through the holes in the top, and we would put our cold feet on there. Mm. And they had been doing these foot warmers for years. My mother would tell me that in the days before there was any heating in the churches, people would carry a big one like that with a nice brass handle, and they would take that to church with them so that the women could sit and, you know, the hot air would go under their skirts, their long skirts. So it was a little bit comfortable, if you can imagine, in these cold, cold churches. Mm. Well, I remember the time that we would go and have the foot warmers at my grandmother's house. And I tell you, in my house today, I still have three foot warmers. One that was definitely my mother's, that she probably brought into marriage in 1913. One that was my dad's, that he had in his study. And one that I got in the 40s from an antique store. So I'm very happy to still have foot warmers, even though I don't use them.
I could have used one on that sledding hill with my icy toes.
You certainly could have. Well, is that time to tell a little bit more, or?
I think it's about time for us to talk about Lopez traditions.
All right,
Sally.
And we'll save my other stories for later. Well, we should talk a little bit about the Lopez traditions, and I think we should start with the weekend of Thanksgiving, when on Friday night things happen in the village.
Yeah, that's the Christmas lighting. And I actually haven't attended that, but I understand that there's bonfires and cider. Everybody's standing around the bonfires and singing some Christmas songs. And then they throw the switch and all the beautiful lights go on in the village. And yeah, cider, songs, and a bonfire. Do you know anything more about it than that?
No, I don't. Yeah. I don't, but it is very joyful. And I have been thinking about one time, but I can't remember when it was, Hummel Lake was frozen over. And that was really an event because even cars could go on it. Now, then it has to be sturdy.
I don't know why cars would want to go on it, but I've heard that story too.
Yeah.
I heard that there was a bonfire out there in the middle of the lake, and which seems a little extraordinary to me, but I asked a friend of mine who has done a lot of work up in Alaska, and he said, sure enough, it's possible to put a bonfire on a frozen lake, as long as that lake is frozen like 2 feet deep.
Right.
Yeah. We've already had a beautiful cold snap this winter, and one of my favorite parts of winter on Lopez is watching the kids ice skate on the frozen ponds. You've had some experience with that.
Right. I know that Stephen Brower and Molly Bill's pond gets frozen over and gives an opportunity to skate.
When I was first on Lopez 14 years ago, I remember being just enchanted by this idea because we lived on the south end, and there, it wasn't Molly's pond, but it was another pond down there, not too far from Watmau, that would freeze over by the big old house. And I remember hearing from some Lopezian, you know, that there was ice skating, and I said, well, shucks, we don't have skates. And they said, don't you worry. They bring out the boxes of skates. All you have to do is go. And just the sight of the big bonfire by the side of the pond there and people skating. This year I enjoyed pulling over and watching the kids on Pickering Pond. They had a bonfire going there, and there were children playing what looked like hockey with some sticks and a ball, and there was a big black Labrador retriever who was slip-sliding away on that pond. So that's a very favorite part of winter on Lopez to me, is watching the kids on the on the ponds.
Well, I want to mention here something that is long gone now, but Sandy and Sally Bill, the parents of all the Bills that you know on Lopez Island, when they were still in their prime, and it lasted a long time, they would have the most beautiful Christmas party. And what I definitely remember of that was the fact that the Christmas tree had real candles, which is what I grew up with as a child. So it always felt very good for me to see the real candles on the Christmas tree, the way it was supposed to be.
Mm. You know, that makes me remember and kind of reflect on Christmas Eve on Lopez at the Episcopal Church, which I've been attending for many, many years, where the local preschoolers do a living nativity. And I always and tell the story of Jesus' birth. And it is, I'm sure the costumes are the same every year, but it's the little children, the little kids who change. And now, you know, some of the children that I saw being Mary and Joseph and the wise men and the angels 10 or 15 years ago are now in college. But it is just delightful to hear the little children sing Silent Night together, and especially to find out who baby Jesus is going to be, Allie, because every year they use a different, the newest baby on the island is baby Jesus, whether he's a boy or a girl. And to watch these little preschoolers handling the baby, and sometimes the baby's got a pacifier in a little his or her mouth, and sometimes their mom has to come up and rescue the baby from Mary, who isn't very proficient at handling a little newborn. But it's always such a precious experience. And then at the end, they douse the lights and it's candlelight, and we all sing a few traditional Christmas carols. And part of that service also is Kristen Fernald and Rosie Sumner sing some beautiful Christmas harmonies from the balcony. It's always a highlight for me on Lopez.
Sounds beautiful. I think you should give a little announcement of our storytelling at the library.
Well, yeah, that's another Christmas tradition, isn't it? Every year at the library, this year it'll be December 30th, 11 a.m. for an hour. Stanley Greenthal and Kip and Rosie and Allie will do their traditional Christmas storytelling. It revolves around the Polar Express, of course, but there are additional stories every year. The storytelling is absolutely for adults as well as children. And I don't know, how many years has that been going on now?
I'm not sure.
But it's been a while.
It's been a while.
Yeah. That reminds me, too, of the Lopez Sound a cappella concert, Christmas concert, that takes place at Center Church at Christmas time here at Lopez. I went to that concert just last night, and I know you and Oscar went to it, too. Very festive. Last night I was especially enjoying, in addition to the beautiful music and the original arrangements, I was especially enjoying the Christmas tree. So tall, that huge Christmas tree at the front of the church, and how tiny and intimate that church is.
Mm-hmm.
It can't hold more than, 100 or 150
something
people?
Like that, 100, I think. Yeah. And it's lovely because it has excellent acoustics.
Mm-hmm. When I think of Christmas on Lopez, I always think of Holly B's gingerbread people. We don't have Christmas without Holly's gingerbread people. Some years it's a hula person or a nun or a boy in jams who's, it depends on where she's been traveling that year, how she makes up her gingerbread people. But it's such a tradition in this family that I send a gingerbread person to my boys whenever I can. This year, Robert is receiving his gingerbread person in France. So it's a big tradition in our family. Anything else on your list?
I think we should also mention, which has already been, but which is a real December solstice celebration, is Stanley Greenthal's concert. And he often has different musicians joining him. And, of course, have Kip join him for drums and harmony.
Yeah.
And that's been going on for years.
And the mention of solstice, of course, reminds me about the long dance, where many, many Lopezians have gathered for 20 or 30 years, I think, now on the shortest evening of the year, the evening of the 21st. Some of them stay until 11 o'clock at night, and others stay dancing and celebrating all night long until the dawn comes. Well, I think, Allie, our time has just about run out here. I know you've got a poem. One last poem for us that has to do with welcoming in the new year.
Well, it's actually a poem to the parting year.
Okay.
It's very short. It's by W.S. Merwin from the book called Present Company, published by Copper Canyon Press. And the title, as I mentioned, is To the Parting Year. So you are leaving everything the way it is, taking only your day with you. Already you are out of reach. You do not know us or hear us. You scarcely remember us. Already we cannot imagine where you are. What we remember of love is starlight.
So, for all of you, we say thank you for listening. We wish everyone a happy and peaceful and prosperous 2010.
And a healthy new year.
This show has been pre-recorded.